Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Surveys reveal that there's about a lifetime prevalence approaching 50% of mental disorders in the United States. If you look at that prevalence over a 12-month period, it's about 25% in adults, 15% in children. And then there's the daily stressors: health, relationships, work problems, divorce, death of a loved one. Our topic today is psychotherapy. What it is, why it works, what makes a good patient, and if we're going to ask that question, we got to ask what's a good therapist. And we may go ahead and ask what's a good therapeutic relationship between the two. My guest today is Dr. Kevin O'Leary, and we're talking psychotherapy. Dr. O'Leary, welcome back to Line One.
Thanks very much.
Well, let's jump right in. Tell me a little bit about psychologists. What's a psychologist? What's a psychiatrist? How you guys trained? What's the difference between psychologists and psychiatrists so that we're all starting at the same place?
There are a bunch of us, meaning mental health professionals out there. Arguably, I don't know, I need to be discreet the way I say this, arguably too many titles and credentials, and I can only imagine it gets very confusing for the lay public. So let me, if I can take a minute, make a run at it right now. I'm a clinical psychologist. The term psychologist basically means you go to school for a really long time, get a doctoral degree. There are two types of doctoral degrees in psychology. You get a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, a doctorate. You write a dissertation. You do a ton. I suppose similar to medical training, you do a ton of clinical field training. And after all of this is done, you work about another 1,500 hours under intense supervision by a senior clinician, and then you sit for a state board exam. When you are done with all of that, you can call yourself a psychologist. You are not a medical doctor. And I think, as you're alluding to, there's great confusion sometimes. I get calls all the time in my office. Can I prescribe drugs? No, I cannot. For the most part, clinical psychologists cannot. There is a movement afoot in some areas of the U.S. to get prescription privileges. That's probably a topic for a different day. For the most part, I think we can say psychologists do not prescribe. Psychiatrists obviously do, because psychiatry is a specialization within the field of traditional medicine, MDs and DOs. There are also a bunch of master's level psychology people out there. And this is where there's actually quite a diversity of training and credentialing. But lots of folks go get a master's degree in psychology, and then they can get licensed at a state level. You'll see initials like LPC, licensed professional counselor, LPA, licensed psychological associate. Social workers go get a master's of social work, an MSW, and then they can become an LCSW, licensed clinical social worker. You can have people who have marriage and family specialties, and they get licensed as LMFTs, licensed marriage and family therapist. And who am I forgetting? I'm always going to forget someone out there. There are also kind of, how do I put it, specialty doctorates, if you will, aside from psychology, and these people can end up practicing therapy. You'll see this commonly with EdDs, Doctors of Education. Mm-hmm. And I believe there's at least one person in town, I believe, who has a DSW, a doctorate in social work. Mm-hmm. So all of these fancy initials and levels of licensure can enable someone to practice psychotherapy or counseling, as some people call it.
Mm-hmm. And at least the way things are in the United States right now, it would have seemed to me that psychologists, doctors of psychologists who don't usually write prescriptions, as you said, will do the psychotherapy. Psychiatrists, which are MDs, really don't do that much psychotherapy. They really have evolved into much more of a medication management specialty, and I don't want to misstate it. Is that generally what's happening?
And I'm going to be equally cautious. We should really have a psychiatrist in here to confirm this, but generally that is very much my impression that the psychologists and the master's level psychology people and the social workers et al. That I just mentioned are really the ones doing the bulk of the talk therapy. The psychiatrists are writing the prescriptions for the medication and managing the medications. Although I think a lot of psychiatrists that I hear about will do less frequent supportive psychotherapy or counseling. They'll meet with a patient, once a month, do check-ins, find out how the meds are working, and do a little on-the-spot cognitive behavioral therapy, which we might talk about here in a minute, what that term actually means.
Mm-hmm. And the two often may work together, both formally or informally, as consultants to each other or within the same business arrangement.
Hopefully, yeah. Yeah. One of the standards of practice is, you know, obviously on an as-needed basis, that therapists and psychiatrists or prescribers in general, a lot of psychotropic medications are now prescribed through family practice doctors as well. So it's a very complicated landscape out there. But all the professionals should be working in concert to whatever degree is necessary. Sometimes it's very complicated. Sometimes it's so simple it's not much is necessary. Depends on the case.
Let me remind listeners, this is Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guest is Dr. Kevin O'Leary. He's an Anchorage psychologist, and we are talking about the broad spectrum of psychotherapy, and we're going to get into what it is and what makes it work successfully when it is successful, and when it doesn't, what may be the problems. If you've got questions or comments about these issues today, let me give you some ways to get a hold of us over the next 55 minutes or so. Our local number in Anchorage is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our email address is line1, and you spell that out, all as one word, at alaskapublic.org. Alaskapublic.org. Line1 at alaskapublic.org. And we do have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. All right. So, Kevin, what is psychotherapy? How do we define that?
That's a tough one for me. This is a really funny moment because knowing I was coming on here, you know, I started to have an experience of doing something every day for basically the last 20 years almost. And then you ask someone like, hey, what's it like breathing oxygen again? So let me see if I can break it down to some reasonable degree here. You know, psychotherapy is traditionally two people getting together to talk. Now, let me start right away by pointing out it doesn't have to be limited to two people. There's obviously couples therapy. There is child play therapy, all sorts of forms of therapy out there. Group therapy is a somewhat common modality of treatment in the U.S. And there are all sorts of, you know, a little off to the side derivatives, which are actually perfectly valid and useful. Art therapy, I mentioned child play therapy, activity therapies. But to answer your question more directly, let's talk about individual therapy for a second. Two people, the professional and the patient, get together in a room, and I'm full of disclaimers. A lot of people get uncomfortable with the term patient. They feel it pathologizes the person. They prefer client or consumer. I totally respect that. I'm trained a bit old school, so I use patient. And they sit down, and much like the first time you go to your family practice doc, the patient will lay out the nature of their difficulties, their concerns, and their problems. And the provider, credentialed in the ways I just talked about, presumably goes to work then, conceptualizing a case, making sense of the material, making sense of what is said to them, much like traditional medicine, laying out a treatment plan of sorts, a methodology, a way to begin thinking about the nature of these problems, and also a way to begin using both insights and tools, and occasionally medication, but again, that would be farmed out to a psychiatrist, to reduce or hopefully resolve the nature of the problems. It can happen over a short period of time. It can happen over a long and sometimes shockingly long to a lot of people period of time. A lot of it depends on the nature of the issues and, as I think we're going to talk a lot about, the nature of the people involved and where their leanings are, to what depth they wish to go into the nature of the difficulties.
So basically you're trying to help people struggle that are struggling with certain problems, and many of these things are amenable with talking it out, helping them see things in maybe different ways, learning more things about themselves and so forth. So there's things that are amenable to this approach and things that must not be amenable to that approach.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, in the good news department, I'm always pleasantly amazed and amused that I always say to people I practice the lowest tech form of medicine available. Two people get together and talk. There's no equipment other than chairs, but it's an age-old fact I think we can embrace. Long before Sigmund Freud and modern psychotherapy was invented, people still used to do this. There was the shaman, the village person that everyone would go to, and this is you can read this in Shakespeare, you can read this in the Greeks. This has been going on a very long time, and I suppose like many things over the course of human evolution, if it's lasted this long, there must be something to it. But it does get complicated, and no, it can't solve every problem, and my hope before the end of the hour is also to speak a little bit about realistic expectations for potential patients going into psychotherapy too, because it's often a bit more emotionally challenging and difficult than some people expect on the front end.
Why is there, perhaps we should ferret out that there are different approaches. You've already mentioned psychoanalytic, you've mentioned the word cognitive behavior therapy, you've mentioned a family therapist, which implies to someone like myself, who's a little bit knowledgeable, that there are multiple different approaches. Why the different approaches? Let me just start there.
Mostly because it's a great question, and I'm laughing at the struggles of my profession and what we all struggle with every day. It's very hard to operationalize and research exactly how psychotherapy works. And hence, it's very hard to arrive at really black and white, cut and dried answers of this is the one type that works best. Mm-hmm. People have tried this a lot over the years of psychotherapy. So what we've arrived at instead is, now this is grossly oversimplified, but a little bit of a different strokes for different folks mentality within the profession. Although any of the mainstream forms of psychotherapy in America and the world today do have a lot of research behind them, that they generally work, that they generally are effective. Mm-hmm. But right, there are different numbers of people in the room. Some folks work just purely with individuals, couples, families, little kids, you name it, groups. And there are different belief systems. And again, when I say belief systems, I don't want to make it sound like, you know, it's just like religious belief. There is a lot of research going on behind the efficacy of all of this, but it is very hard to prove psychotherapy outcomes and effectiveness in the same way you kind of like prove the law of gravity. Right. It's not that black and white.
Right, right. Yeah, there are, in my understanding, particularly with cognitive behavioral therapy and certain problems, there's very good blinded treatment efforts that show that kind of behavioral therapy is very effective, for example, even versus medications. There's studies that have looked. So there is some significant science behind some of these things, it appears to me, and maybe more than I'm aware of anyway.
Well, there's really good news for the profession of psychotherapy, and more importantly than that, for the patients out there in psychotherapy and seeking psychotherapy, in that over time, the research seems to be showing that talk therapy, is even more effective than we used to think. Right. And right, you'll get really astounding research results that in places it is more, if a patient has to choose between just medication and just COGB, cognitive behavioral psychotherapy, in many instances the COGB therapy will prove itself to be more effective. Mm-hmm. I attended, just as a brief but somewhat astounding illustration, of the importance of environmental influences and emotional influences on our state of mind. I attended a conference recently where research was presented regarding very sick teenagers with psychotic symptoms, meaning teenagers who display thoughts and beliefs that are very far removed from reality, that rather than give them psychotropic, antipsychotic, neuroleptic medication, a study was done that strove to reduce the level of expressed emotion, which normally means untoward, chaotic, crazy emotion, in the kids' families. And the families that were successful in doing that, reducing the EE, reducing the levels of expressed emotions, those kids exhibited better symptom relief than the kids who are on medications, which I think my jaw nearly hit the floor when I heard this outcome. Because I think even 10 or 20 years ago in my line of work, people would have totally laughed at that and said, that's not possible. You have to medicate. So there's a lot of very powerful, interesting stuff coming to light.
Mm-hmm. The way I think about it suggests that there's definitely some feedback from the environment in what we see in a psychotic individual, whether it's promoting it or, you know, encouraging it or whatever. I mean, it suggests that there's something about the way the environment, people in their environment are responding to that person may drive it a little bit is what I guess.
Absolutely. When I was in school in, you know, roughly the early 90s, again, people would have been outraged that I would even suggest such a thing. And again, I'm not saying this is a fact. This is just one research study, and this was the outcome they found. So it's just of interest. Nothing set in stone here. But yeah, roughly 20 years ago, people would have laughed. That's not possible. Psychosis is purely a brain disorder. It doesn't matter what you do in the environment. I think we're learning that it really does.
So among these professionals that are performing psychotherapy, there are a number of different psychotherapeutic approaches. The classic one is psychoanalysis.
Indeed.
That's where I guess things got more formalized into some some cause and effect thinking.
That's a good way to put it. Yes, we can talk all about this. Yes.
That may not have held water over time, so may give some people some bad feelings, but then that's not where we are today. Things are much different with psychotherapy than just old-fashioned psychoanalysis that Freud was doing.
Things are much, much different, and I cannot overstate the importance of the point I think you're getting at, that it's very important for potential consumers of psychotherapy services not to enter into the process, or even worse, avoid entering into the process because of old and, I really think, outdated, hopefully outdated, stereotypes of what goes on. Although in America and in the world, psychoanalytic therapy, and more informally called psychodynamic therapy now, is really alive and well. And you're talking to one of the practitioners of it, actually, generally speaking. Although there's a wide range of therapies out there. And I can talk for a minute about a quick and dirty way to conceptualize that.
Sure.
If people could kind of put it on a big continuum, put it on a big line, at one end of the line, you'd probably have what we might call behaviorism, which is a school of thinking, and at the other end of the line, by the way, you would probably have formal psychoanalysis or what I would call an existential analysis. You know, put it out there as the presumably deepest form of digging into unconscious processes, okay? And this would be one way to think about the continuum of what's available. Behaviorism, as the name implies, is simply interested in behavior change. It doesn't really care about the whys, the whats, the motivations of the individual. It can be very effective. It can be very powerful. It's often behaviorally enacted more than discussed, because discussion is largely, not always, but largely a tool for insight. One step down this line that I'm laying out here is the very common and popular cognitive behavioral therapy, which I would, I suppose, gently put out there as really the form of mainstream American therapy today. Highly researched, highly validated. And it's probably worth knowing that, you know, COGB therapy, really everyone's a COGB therapist. Every therapist out there practices cognitive behavioral techniques at some level. It's almost impossible for me to imagine that someone could perform therapy in 2012 without utilizing at least some COGB techniques. So we talked about the behaviorism. The cognition part just basically refers to conscious level thinking, what your thought systems are, what your belief systems are. And it's very powerful in when the therapist can catch erroneous thinking, illogical thinking. Very powerful, can often yield results in a short period of time. Very popular with the healthcare troubles in America today. Very popular with insurance companies. Very popular with people's pocketbooks. There's a lot to like about it. Further down the line, you get into what I would probably call the digging deeper therapies, which admittedly are not for everyone, but they definitely are for some people. And as I just said, with digging deeper, there's a kind of an assumption, a belief, as we go further down the line, in the unconscious, which sounds a bit mystical and huru-guru, although there are ways to empirically validate that we all have one, quite simply meaning that there are parts of our minds that are at work, but we don't know what they're up to at any given moment. Mm-hmm. This is a silly way to illustrate the point, but hey, Dr. Thad, Japan. Mm-hmm. You probably were not thinking about the nation of Japan right at the moment I brought it up, and yet the notion of Japan just existing as a piece of land is, of course, in you. We would call that actually subconscious, but it just illustrates the point that there's all sorts of stuff in us that we're just literally not thinking about at the time. More psychodynamically.
And those affect what we do subconsciously as well.
Yes.
And our choices are and what we believe.
Right.
Yeah. That's kind of fascinating stuff that's coming out with some of the cognitive psychology. But anyway, go ahead.
Yes. That they are. Well, no, you just hit on the core point of it, that it's almost like you can have a GPS system running, driving the car, if you will, but you're not really looking at the screen of it. You don't know what points are being plotted. And that, of course, can cause a lot of distress and surprise in a person's life. So the goal of the more insight-oriented therapies is to bring that stuff to light, let the patient and the therapist have a look at it and understand what's going on. Okay. And that's a very quick and dirty, rough way to conceptualize a whole spectrum of ways therapists think about their work.
Okay. Who is it for? Who is psychotherapy designed for?
The good news is in 2012, and yeah, I'm going to sound a little bit like a salesman for the stuff, because I am a bit of a salesman for the stuff. I am a true believer. It's potentially for everyone who is suffering emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
Potentially. Mm-hmm. There is, like every medical procedure, there is no 100% guarantee of a successful outcome. Mm-hmm. Although the odds of getting at least some relief in psychotherapy are actually quite high. and the odds of something really bad or catastrophic happening by attending psychotherapy are quite low. Mm-hmm. So I like to think that psychotherapy is available and out there for almost everyone who, you know, on the more depressing end of the spectrum is suffering with depression, right. anxiety, relationship problems, all the traumas and mm-hmm. stressors you listed out. Yeah. And some people also are just interested in wanting to know what's going on mm-hmm. inside themselves. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we all have, or many of us have, a lot of issues going on, and many of us hide those issues, cover them up, don't address them, or use illicit drugs or alcohol
Absolutely.
Or cigarette or food to address those issues.
Sadly, yes.
Whether we realize that's what we're doing or not.
Sadly, yes. Yes.
And so the point is, the saying I had in one of my exam rooms for a long time is probably true. It said, no family can say there's no problems here.
There is an assumption generally in my line of work, especially if you have psychodynamic training, that everyone is neurotic at some level.
Yeah.
That everyone has issues at some level.
Right.
Now, whether you choose to do something about them, to what degree they're bothering you, you know, is a million-dollar question.
Different issues.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you're also very wise in pointing out that there's this very fascinating discussion to be had around symptom formation and symptom substitution. Why we eat too much, mm-hmm. why we go to Vegas too much, why we drink too much, why we fill in the blank too much. Mm-hmm. Something's bothering us, I would gently suggest. Yes. Sometimes not that gently, depending on how well people know me, but I'm gentle today, so there you go.
We've had a caller waiting for a couple minutes. I think I should go ahead and see what she's got to ask us. Mary, you're on line one.
Oh, hi. I have a 17-year-old boy diagnosed with depression, anxiety, and panic attacks relating to school. And I'm wondering, he's been in talk therapy, psychotherapy, whatever, and he's stopped that because he's tired of talking about it. And I'm wondering another thing that might be meditation, yoga, anything like that. Does Dr. O'Leary have any opinions on that?
Right. Okay. So basically the issue is we have a kid who's got a common problem. I mean, this mm-hmm. is not very uncommon to have, you know, some depression and anxiety and depression almost are in the run together pretty well, panic attacks and in school. And I'm sure you're going to say, or one of the things I expect you to say is, you know, you need to know a lot more information to answer this
exactly.
question. But the issue is it's not working what he's doing. So what are the options here?
And of course, right, I'm going to issue my little legal disclaimer. This is not Fraser Crane. This is not, you know, I can't really diagnose and put together treatment plans for people I've never met. But generally speaking, yoga and meditation, I think, are fine choices. I mean, I have a lot of questions about what Mary just said. Yoga and meditation are fine choices if done properly. There's very little that can go wrong. I mean, watch the yoga, that people can get injured a little bit. But, you know, in my role as psychologist, one hypothetical question I would have is, what has become of the talk therapy that the young man does not wish to engage in it anymore? There's most likely a backstory to that I would just be very curious about, because therapies do stall out. Therapies go flat. I think it's actually quite common and perhaps not talked about enough. And I think it's really important for therapists and patients to be working very hard collaboratively to ask, why is that happening? How can we avoid it? What can we do about it? Is a different approach or a different therapist needed? No simple answers here, but lots of questions. There's something in me that's slow to just take it at face value, right. that like the kid got tired of talking, so let's tank the therapy.
Right,
you know?
Right.
Yeah.
So, Mary, I'm a pediatrician, and I immediately, when you said this, I have a boy I'm seeing currently with exactly the same situation who I've been trying to get into psychotherapy for a number of months. I've treated him with medication because that has helped him, but I look at this as not the long-term answer. I keep talking to him about that, but I have struggled just getting him into therapy. So I think I'm going to guess that Dr. O'Leary would say where patients are coming from, where clients are coming from, how we would describe it, have a lot to do with how the success whether this stuff is going to work or not. And teenagers are, in my mind, typically very, I would expect, difficult to work with in the first place.
I treat a fair number of teenagers, and definitely a different, I don't even know how to summarize it. They require different things.
Mm-hmm.
God bless them. I'm saying it with a smile on my face. They're teenagers. So a lot of
therapists. So you're searching sometimes with the right approach.
Absolutely.
Right.
Everyone needs to be engaged, but teenagers really need to be engaged. The therapy really needs to be brought to life for young people, or it's very easy for them to lapse into that typical teenage angst and laissez-faire, whatever dude attitude. And it can be toxic, of course. It can be death for the therapy if it's not handled.
I don't know if that helps much, Mary. Certainly, these are situations that, you know, my first thought is you need to really keep a mind's eye on this. He's at high risk with these kinds of diagnoses, I think, for hurting himself, unfortunately. I don't know if I should say that, but I felt like I should, Kevin.
Definitely. You know, we have an appointment with another therapist, and we'll see how that goes.
Good.
But I was just curious about the meditation, you know, the calming techniques and things like that.
Right.
It feels like a million years ago now, but I basically wrote my doctoral dissertation on meditation. So I'm a huge believer in it. It's very powerful stuff. And, you know, if done properly, he should do a little research on it beforehand. But if done properly and within some established guidelines, there's a lot that can go right and very little that can go wrong. It's good stuff.
Right. Great. Thanks for your call.
Before we take a break, let me move forward in this therapeutic relationship issue that I think is very important that we get into. And let's talk about what makes a good client. What are the factors that increase the likelihood of success in psychotherapy, if that's a reasonable question to ask? I know it certainly is true in medicine, so
absolutely.
I'm assuming it's true in psychology as well.
Absolutely. I think, and this may or may not have to even do with the call we just took, I think there's a question for any patient around what do they really want? What are they looking for? Psychotherapy requires a very collaborative effort between patient and provider. It's not like, hey, I have an ear infection, doc, just give me some drops to put in my ears, in 3 days it'll be gone. There's a lot of work that has to go on a patient's part. And again, I mean, I say with a smile on my face, especially treating teenagers, when you start talking about, hey, I have more homework for you to do, you can imagine the response you often get. But what to get back to the question, one of the things that makes a good patient is someone with motivation, work ethic, I dare say. And one answer I always have to this question is courage. The willingness to get into the process, to value the process, and get motivated to look at what a therapist may really be offering in terms of both insight and coping strategies to reduce those symptoms.
So it sounds like to me it also requires some trust. I mean, you've got to... you know, give it away. You get the things you may not want to talk about. And that's where the courage, and then you got to have some trust. So there has to be some relationship established. I guess I'm answering my own question.
There's a great funny line in the movie Kissing Jessica Stein where Jessica's friend is advising her to take her woes to her therapist. And Jessica says back, oh, God, no, I could never do that. This is private. You know, and you'd be amazed the number of people that I have treated really for years who finally are able to come clean with me about, you know, so to speak, whatever's really going on in their lives. But I don't say it sarcastically or judgmentally. I say it to acknowledge how hard it really is to lay yourself bare, to put the contents of your mind and your most fragile thoughts and feelings on the table, which is really what's required sooner or later for something good to happen in the therapy process. So it takes a lot of courage.
Yeah, from what I understand about it's reading some of the recent stuff in cognitive psychology is our mind is sitting there. It's designed to protect us. We think about that. And I believe strongly in evolution. And we evolved in a situation where we had to make quick decisions about whether that growl is a cat or a mountain lion. But we also had to develop an ego. We had to protect our feelings. So we go through a lot of macerations in our mind that's designed to kind of protect ourselves. And so it's hard to sit out there and talk about this stuff that we are pulling down and putting ourselves at risk when it turns out sometimes to be the best thing to do, but our natural instinct, our evolved instinct is to protect ourselves.
I think it's a million-dollar point you just made, especially the evolutionary aspect of it and the the intrapsychic aspects, the inside yourself aspects of it. Coming to therapy is often a profound breaking of the rules that a person has been living with, often for their whole life.
Right.
It's very taboo in many, many ways. And there is all sorts of shame and stigma associated with it. Yeah, maybe you don't want to tell your buddy you're seeing the shrink. Oh, God, gasp, it's terrible. But I'm actually talking about a person's own feelings of embarrassment, humiliation, shame, anxiety. Here's a very common one I treat virtually on a daily basis. A feeling of betraying the parental ideas or the family of origin ideas. In order for someone to get better, they often need to move beyond some of the ideas they grew up with. And that dynamic is often met with tremendous resistance in my office.
It's fascinating stuff. We do have to take a short break, and then we'll continue to talk about this. My guest today is Dr. Kevin O'Leary. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. If you've got questions or comments about what you're listening to, our local number is 550-8433. You can email us at line1@alaskapublic.org, and we also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. We'll be right back. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcast of Line 1, Your Health Connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Anchorage psychologist, Dr. Kevin O'Leary. Our topic is basically the general area of psychotherapy. We've been talking about what it is, who practices it, what are the purposes. We've recently just discussed what makes a good client, a person who's receptive to the psychotherapy. If you've got questions or comments during the next 30 minutes or so, you can email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us at 550-8433. Our website has some links and a very good couple of short, one longer and one shorter video about some of the aspects of psychotherapy we're not going to get into. And you can reach that at alaskapublic.org. Remember also that if you're listening between 7 and 8 o'clock on Monday night, you're listening to a rebroadcast. That also points out that at any time you can go to alaskapublic.org and listen to this program and prior programs if you would like to. So, Dr. O'Leary, you said people have to make an effort. They have to have motivation. So it sounds like there's some work going on here. Tell us about this relationship that you're forming with this patient, and why do they have to work?
If it's good therapy, there is definitely work going on, and it is heavy lifting work. It should not just be chatting. There should be digging. There should be reformulating of what some people call a person's life script, life narrative. And a lot of research has been done around the key ingredients, so to speak, what makes for effective psychotherapy. And psychotherapy is largely measured in what we call the terms of the quality of the relationship. And I've got a study sitting in front of me right now, the results of it anyways, although I have a feeling the study has been replicated in about a million different places because I've seen this list a lot, and it'd probably be wise to share it with everyone because here are what has been found repeatedly to be true regarding the psychotherapy relationship. Psychotherapy is indeed generally effective. The specific type of psychotherapy treatment offered is often not a factor in the success or outcome of the case. The theoretical bases of the techniques used and the strictness of adherence to those techniques are both not factors. However, the therapist's strength of belief in the efficacy of the technique is a factor. How much the therapist believes in what he or she is doing is much more of an indicator of things going well than the content of what they actually believe in, which is fascinating to me. The personality structure of the therapist himself is a significant factor. And the biggest key factor, the big enchilada of the whole thing, is the alliance between the patient and the therapist, meaning affectionate and trusting feelings toward the therapist, motivation and collaboration with the client, and empathetic response of the therapist is the key factor.
Mm-hmm. So if I'm a psychotherapist, what I'm taken out of this is I've got to learn how to really get through to this person pretty quickly.
Yes, there are pressures.
And to trust me and be willing to try a few things, and we're looking for quick results, because I know in medicine I don't get many tries if things don't start getting better pretty quick.
It is definitely one of the pressures I live in almost on a daily basis, especially with the first hour with a new patient. They need to walk out of my office feeling like they got something. Mm-hmm. Because I think the human experience of feeling relieved or unburdened, even just a little bit, even being in the presence of somebody who understood something, is huge. It does not solve all your problems. It does not solve all the world problems. But you know what? It strengthens and bolsters a person to come back and fight another day.
All right. So if I'm listening to you and hearing you, what I'm hearing, and you may have to straighten me out, is I'm coming to you and I have all these subconscious biases built into my mind from years and years ago and affected by growing up. And you're going to ask me, or you're going to tell me, that those things need to come out and we need to talk about them and look at them and analyze them and think about them and see if they make sense, because they're causing me harm.
That's exactly what I'm saying. That's exactly what I'm saying.
Is that what
well
you're
summarized.
Saying?
That is exactly what I'm saying.
So
it sounds like fun, doesn't it?
Yeah. So that's why I'm depressed. That's why I'm unhappy. That's why I can't make a 3-foot putt under pressure.
Right.
That's why we have performance anxieties. How we are subconsciously almost analyzing this situation that you're in.
There's an assumption that somewhere in that matrix in your mind, in all mm-hmm. that glop of stuff in your mind that you just laid out, there is an assumption on my part, on therapist's part, that there's a problem in there.
Mm-hmm.
There's something, there's a hook, mm-hmm. or most mm-hmm. likely a constellation of hooks mm-hmm. that, to put it bluntly, are not grounded in reality.
Mm-hmm.
Don't match up with how you work and how the world works, because there's something in you that's, you're not adjusting to it. You're not living with a nice, tight puzzle piece fit with what goes on inside you and around you. And we've got to smooth that out. We've got to figure out what's going on there.
Give me an example. What's a common example of what you're talking about?
This is a bit vague, but the big one that, there's no way to cookie cutter everything, but I think a lot of roads commonly lead back to a conscious or unconscious belief inside people of basically shame.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not worthy of it. I'm not good enough. I'm plain old not good.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the funny, haha, funny, weird, not funny, humorous part of that is, if you ask most people walking around on the street, hey, how do you feel about yourself? You'll get, feel pretty good, you know?
Right.
But if you get into the details, and psychotherapy is very much done in the details, not sweeping generalizations, a lot of roads slowly over time will lead to evidence that there are profound exceptions to that belief. Hey, I feel pretty good about myself. Yeah, I'm a good person. Well, what about A, B, and C? What about the relationship choice you made? What about the educational choice, the job choice, the friendship choice, and as you were alluding to, the alcoholism mm-hmm. choice, and that mm-hmm. phrase will make a lot of people mad because it's mm-hmm. not a conscious level choice. I'm not, no one right. chooses that consciously. But it gets very complicated. But people do make choices in the world.
Mm-hmm. So we're all a lot more insecure than we're willing to admit or certainly show other people. Is that the right term?
I would agree with that statement. Hmm. Some people might not.
Mm-hmm.
I can certainly understand why that statement would make a lot of people uncomfortable, because it mm-hmm. rocks the boat for us.
Mm-hmm.
But there is an assumption, certainly inside me, and I think I can speak on behalf of a lot of my profession, that we start with that in laying out, tell me your story, tell me what's going on, and we look at this, I call it a matrix, this puzzle of how the person's mind works. We assume, okay, there must be a glitch in here somewhere, and it is my job to find and retrieve, like a bloodhound, sniff out that glitch. and begin talking about it and bringing it to the person. But again, it's not done passively. The patient does not just sit there. The patient is a highly active collaborator in that process. They've got to give you the material. And I'm also a staunch believer in that you need the patient's confirmation of the material, too. You can't just make stuff up and tell it to someone. Mm-hmm. There has to be a constant checking in of, is this right? Does this make sense? Does this feel or seem true to you? Because a relationship and a new fact pattern, a new life narrative has to be built collaboratively. That's really how I think the process works at a very deep level.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds to me it must be deeper. I have never ever thought about this, so I'm going to sound crazy maybe. But then the self-talk that we all have. I mean, that's one level, it seems to me, is although I may feel like and say I think I'm a good athlete, I may really, my self-talk is a lot of doubt, but then there's something even lower down, further down in there that's problematic.
There are layers, I would strongly believe, of self-talk. And what happens over time in therapy, and it's normally good news, is that, you know, weeks or months or sometimes years into the process, a patient will come in and say, wow, over the weekend, I could almost hear these voices in my head saying, you're no good, you're not worthy of this, or, right. or some such report. Right. And that sounds horrible, and it is horrible, but it's actually really good news for the therapy. Not that they're literally hearing voices, but they're getting in touch with a deeper subtext of what they've been telling themselves, quite possibly their whole lives, but they just didn't really know it.
Mm-hmm. So they're thinking about what they think.
Right. That's a really good summary.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, they're thinking about what
and
they
cognitive
think.
Behavioral therapy to me says, does that make sense? Is it rational?
And then you fact check it. Right. You reality test it.
So that's
it.
What you do. Is you're, in a sense, you're trying to get people to start thinking about that in a rational way. Does it really make sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You dig deep with people, and then there's a whole art and science to popping back out and saying, does it match up with your life?
To me, there are some people who just seem to be well-adjusted. You know, they are, okay? I don't know if it's just my interpretation of them or, you know, and I'm wrong or what, or maybe they've all had 10 years of psychotherapy. I don't know. But my feeling is some people are naturally better adjusted, just like there's some people that are better athletes and some people are better lawyers and some are better at memory. Is that true? And if so, what does it tell us? What does it help? How does it help us understand this?
It's a very complicated topic, but I would generally agree with what you just said. And certainly even within the rather skewed sample of my patient population, there are certainly people who are far better adjusted than others. I think there's an issue of content and process. There's both the thoughts, feelings, and values a person has, content, and there's also the process by which they hold themselves, their mind, together. A really quick and dirty way to talk about it is, do they leak or are they contained? And that speaks to really esoteric, complicated issues around the structure of one's personality, how a person is actually built, which is a pretty conceptual idea. I mean, you can't reach out and put your finger on that. But a lot of theoretical work has been done in my business, and then it tries to be researched and empiricized as best it can be. And anecdotally, I can assure you it seems really true to me, given what I see in my office. Some people are built better. But even folks who unfortunately don't have that kind of background, upbringing, good karma, good luck, whatever you believe in, as I was saying earlier, that's where we go to work and try to tweak it.
I'm always interested in the nature-nurture argument. Well, that question I ask is how come some are? Is it some people are innate, the way their mind works from the get-go is better? Is it upbringing? Is it a combination of the two? Or is it like a lot of health issues? I don't know. Flip a coin.
You get into some heavy-duty, I would probably argue philosophy even more than psychology at some level. But I'll tell you this, there's new research going on, and people know these terms now because they're out in the books, the plastic brain, neuroplasticity. There's a lot of exciting stuff going on that seems to be hinting at, it's not set in stone, but seems to be hinting at that the interplay between actual formation of you know, medical biological structures, the brain itself, is much more heavily influenced by the developmental environment than we were able to study before. So nature versus nurture is either getting a whole lot complicated or may actually be falling by the wayside because I think there's a lot of evidence that it's both. And there's a constant second-by-second dance going on around that. And that's really complicated business.
All right. I've been remiss because I've been caught up in the conversation. If you've got questions or comments, let me give you a couple of ways to give us a call. We've got about a little less than 15 minutes to go. Our local number, 550-8433. 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. What are the more common issues that you're addressing with clients or patients? I think about patients myself. I mentioned clients because I know there's this.
Most people like clients. I still use patients. All right. You know, no big deal to me.
What are you addressing with people?
Depression, anxiety, relationship issues. Depression, anxiety, relationship issues. Those are the three that probably account for 99% of my practice.
Okay. So why is that?
sheer good old prevalence rates. No kidding, Kevin. You know, the DSM, which is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, it's the big diagnostic Bible we all follow, I believe has something like 600 plus diagnoses in it. But a lot of those esoteric, minute diagnoses can really just fall under larger umbrellas of that's an anxiety problem, that's a depression problem. And of course, relationship issues are constantly feeding anxiety and depression because we're highly relational creatures and we always want to get it right with our spouses and our kids and our boss at work. And we rarely get it perfectly, you know, so it creates friction. And in they come to see me, and I'm very grateful for it.
Okay. Janet, thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, one, I want to agree with everything that you doctors have been saying. I'm a great believer in psychotherapy.
Great.
And I have a question, and then I have my own personal philosophy about the need to go. I always say, well, when I started this last time, I usually go in about every 5 years just for a checkup, you know, like doing cars. There's always something going on. But the last time I went was after the suicide of our son.
Sorry.
And I just moved into a new city and had made some new friends. And I said, I told them I was going to go to for a checkup, and I really, really needed it. And they went, oh, you can't go. Everybody in town will be talking about you. And I said, I don't care. Yeah. This is what I need. So four of my friends followed me. So I think, one, being able to talk about it is a really, really good thing and might encourage other people who have problems to go as well. Mm-hmm. And I say, you don't try to, you know, overhaul your own car engine, do you? Mm-hmm. No. Well, of course, that's not your job. This is the job and the training that these people have. They will help you. So that's my personal philosophy. But secondly, I want to know if, in your experience, that one gender or another is more amenable to psychotherapy.
Oh, you women are much more. I'll jump at that one, but anyway, because of our culture. But let's see what Dr.
I have absolutely nothing to add to that. I probably run on average 60-70% females in my psychotherapy practice. Yeah. I think females are much more socialized.
Women are taking
to
over the world, Janet. They're going to college more than boys. We can't find enough men willing to work hard enough to do
That's
anything.
That's right. We're all a bunch of screw-ups. You guys got it going on. I agree. I totally agree. You guys got it going on. You're going to rule the world here shortly.
Men just got the wrong, they got the wrong cultural attitude, the wrong genetics. I don't know what it is. We just think we're going to supposed to gut it out, get through it. Don't talk to anybody. That's embarrassing. You know, that's, I don't know. That's my feeling.
We like to play golf. I mean,
that's got to
count for something.
Yeah, we like
but,
to.
I probably do consistently have over 50%, well over 50% of my caseload is female. And I think the reasons are pretty obvious. Women are much more adept naturally, if you will, nature versus nurture, whatever, but let's say naturally, at digging a little deeper and talking about things, although briefly salesmanship, here we go, let that be a challenge to the guys, because in response to Janet's comments, I do want to chime in with that very unfortunately, stigma and shame about going to therapy is alive and well in the world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, generally speaking, what can I say? I wish it weren't. And I think Janet put it very, very well that there's often a sense that I get from people that it's a moral failing. They've done something really wrong, almost in a moral sense, and now they need to go, you know, confess it to the parish priest or something. And just let me assure you, it's really not like that. And if your therapy does feel like that, it shouldn't, and you need to do something about it. It should really just be helpful and relieving. So I really appreciate Janet's comments.
Janet, thanks for your call.
May I say one more thing?
Sure.
The last time I went to therapy, I actually, and this goes back to what the doctor was saying, the first two people to which I was assigned were just terrible. And I, you know, stayed there for a few sessions. But then I found, I mean, I don't think that people should say or feel that they have to stay with a therapist that they choose, that is chosen for them or that they choose. They should, you know, give them a chance. And then if it's not working and they're not compatible, like the empathy that was spoken about, then they should take it upon themselves to find someone else.
I couldn't agree more. I couldn't agree more. And there's a lot of responsibility. And it's fair or unfair, there's responsibility on the patient to be the owner of their own therapy and make those judgments. On the one hand, be fair to your therapist and give him or her a chance to get it right. But on the other hand, if you really think you're in, you know, a sinking ship, for lack of a better term, you need to acknowledge that, talk to the therapist about it, and move on if there's no remediation. Absolutely move on.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much. This
thank
is
you.
I listen to Anchorage every time I come home, every time I come back here, and I'm going, this is a show that I really, really appreciate. I've gotten so much information from it. So thank
All
you
right.
very much.
All right. Have a good evening or afternoon. Rick, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hey, good afternoon. A comment and a question regarding EMD, eye movement desensitization. I was involved in traumatic event a couple of decades ago, loss of life. I was both consciously and subconsciously traumatized, you know, and really struggling for a long time, and went with an experimental eye movement desensitization therapy. It didn't last very long, and was remarkably relieved from those issues. And I just wanted to find out. I haven't heard much about it, but I presume it's still going on. If you could just address it a little bit and explain it for people who are unaware of it, just and let me know if it's still a viable thing, if it's growing, et cetera. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for your call.
It is, and it is. It's out there. We have, I believe, numerous local practitioners who offer it. I am not one of them. But I'm just an old dog who refuses to learn new tricks. I think from what I have heard and the research I have read, it remains a viable choice. And like we've just discussed with this phone call and the last one, you know, nothing is a cure-all, nothing's a panacea, but if approached with a critical mind and you get relief with no untoward side effects, congratulations. I'm glad you got relief.
Yeah. The impression I still hold on to is that the theory behind it was that it was that if our dream state processes a lot of our issues, that this was designed to try to emulate what at least physiologically goes on with us in dreams and rapid eye movement stuff. And I don't know if that's the actual source for its initiation, but I really liked the idea of it, and it, like I said, it was very effective for me.
All right.
I'm glad to hear it. I do not know much about the neurochemistry, the biology behind it, but it's out there. You can research it, yes.
Yeah, and again, I don't know if that's just the simple layman's expression or explanation for where it came from, but basically, you know, for those that are interested in knowing what the heck I'm talking about, it essentially was in visualizing issues, but in combining that with doing some eye movement, sort of fairly, you know, radically, you know, left to right, up, down, mm-hmm. eye movement in a relaxed setting. And it seems kind of like a, you know, maybe hokey for somebody who's just trying to understand what I'm talking about. But considering I could not clear my mind of recurring, you know, thoughts about this painful situation and dreams that were waking me up, it was very effective. So anyway, if for those that are interested in something that's a little different but effective for some, I would at least encourage them to look into EMD.
All right. Thanks for your comments.
Thanks for your time. Bye.
Have a good day. How do you find a good therapist? What are the hints?
You know, the literal act of finding them, referral from someone you know is probably the best way to do it. Here locally in Anchorage, there's a directory online, the Alaska Psych Association. You can Google it, and we're all kind of listed there with our little areas of specialty. But I think the key moment is not so much, you know, how to find someone's phone number as much as how to make sense of the first session. And we've touched on some of the key ingredients around that. The ability to walk out of the first session feeling understood, feeling that there was a grasp of what you were trying to communicate to the therapist, and also coming away with an impression that the therapist is someone that you either do or could like, admire, respect, connect with. Therapy becomes a remarkably intimate relationship. Not physically intimate, but remarkably emotionally intimate. And so, you know, it's a terrible analogy, but you really are going on a very important first date in your first hour with someone and thinking about, you know, do I want to spend time with someone and reveal with this person and reveal aspects of myself? Very key question.
Couple of minutes left. How do you know it's working? How do you know the therapy is worth continuing? Are there hints? I mean, do you just intuitively have a feeling that this is, I've got this relationship, it's working, and the relationship is not working?
More empirically minded people will, meaning therapists, will actually measure it with tools. Beck depression inventories and little pencil and paper measures, okay, which I totally respect because I am old school. I rely a lot on patient report, which, if the relationship is built properly, I would strongly suggest patients should be very proactive in coming in saying, hey, I think this is working. Or, of course, once the game gets very complicated, I think A, B, and C are going really well. But, hey, Dr. Kevin, man, D, E, and F that you've been talking about, I've got some concerns and questions about. And that's the patient's job. And then it becomes my job to say, all right, let's talk about D, E, and F. Let's make sense of this.
Any final comments? We've got about 30 seconds before I'm going to say thanks and talk about next week's program. What are your final thoughts?
It has been delightful to be here. I wish people did not carry any kind of moral stigma or shame about going.
Right.
I think a lot of human misery could be avoided just by setting foot in the office and giving it a try with good critical thinking intact.
Yeah. I've said it before, and I'll say it again at this particular thing. I think we ought to have primarily mental health insurance and have supplemental physical
insurance. I love it.
We just don't appreciate how much the psychological aspects of health are costing this country.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
All right. Thanks very much for being here.
Thanks very much for having me. It's been great.
If you'd like to continue the conversation, please join KSKA on Facebook. You can find that link at alaskapublic.org. Why don't you join us next Monday afternoon, July 30th. Our guest is going to be one of the nation's most respected healthcare economists, Dr. Uwe Reinhardt of Princeton University. It'll be his third appearance on Line One. So why not tune into your health and learn more Monday, July 30th from 2 to 3 p.m. Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor and our audio engineer today. Thanks for listening, and especially to those who took the time to call or email. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line One, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400.